Coming up on this episode of Free Lunch.
I was out of work for a couple months, and then I called them back. I said, you know, I'm feeling well enough that I can go back to work. And they're like, oh, we thought you were going to die. So we went ahead and replaced your job.
I want to normalize saying, I don't know.
Oh, thank you very much.
Like, is that bad? Like,
that is beautiful. That
let's
is
normalize,
so
I don't know.
That's so important. The number one thing I can say as a parent is to forgive yourself. Forgive
wow.
yourself. When you look back and you yeah. think of all the things you could have done differently, you know what? Forgive yourself.
She's not really a nice person if she loses, though.
Oh.
Yeah. I get in trouble. I have to, if I know I'm about to win, I put my last card down and I run.
Oh. How your career becomes your identity, and it really shouldn't be your identity.
No.
Your career is not who you are. Yeah.
You know, the flathead is like mocking the hammer because the hammer can't, you know, get the screw out. Right. And so, okay, is the hammer unsuccessful? Well, yeah, at that particular outcome.
At that outcome, yeah.
Yeah, it is. But there's a goal that the hammer has that it's successful. So
it's Free Lunch Season 3 with a special thanks to our sponsors, Bullseye-LLC.com, Ready, Aim, Bullseye, where safety is our ammo, Gen1LLC.info, Generation 1 Logistics, taking pride in putting our carriers first and helping owner-operators get premium loads, stay organized, and increase profit, and ScarletOakCandleCo.com, the self-care experts.
What's going on, everybody? It's your boy Freestyle Gospel, aka The Real Free, with another episode of Free Lunch. And I have a special guest here today. Every guest is special, guys, so we already know that. But again, I always think every guest is uniquely extra special. So yet again, another extra special guest.
So nice, thank you.
Amy Chai, everyone. Amy Chai, let's give it up for her. Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming, Amy.
Glad to be here.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I first want to, you know, give everyone kind of an idea of what makes Amy so special. How does she make it into the room on this amazing sofa? And that's just
a very nice sofa, by the way.
Thank you.
It's so
thank
cushiony
you.
And soft, and with the hot tea, it's awesome.
With the tea, Fusion Teas. Shout out to Fusion Teas. So this past weekend, I had the pleasure of being at a literary event, some excellent book authors, some other great vendors too, but it was held at a library, local library here. And I came across a table with, because this is awesome. This is awesome. I mean, she has several things that are awesome, guys, so you'll get to find that out. But anyways, this is the most awesome. So I came across this book on a table, a bunch of these books. And I have a passion for kids, you know, all things youth. So it has a picture of some kids on it. So I flipped on the back. I had no idea who Dr. Amy Chai was. That's, you know, the author there. So I flipped it over. And it's like, Dr. Amy Chai, physician, author, mother, and U.S. congressional candidate. And I'm like, yeah, right. In what reality? So I know what it's like to have a bunch of different hats.
Yeah.
Just being a husband and a dad by itself is...
The older you get, the more hats you have.
Yeah, that's just astounding to me, pulling off all these titles, all these things. I look forward to jumping into the book. But before I go any further, I want to give you a chance to just introduce yourself to the listeners. How does Amy typically introduce herself to the world? Who is Amy?
Oh, well, I
know that's a loaded question.
That's such a difficult question. I just identify, obviously, as myself. I'm somebody who I kind of see myself as somebody who's really dedicated my life to actually my family and also my faith and also serving others. And that's what I do. That's what I've always done. I have sort of supported my husband throughout his life mm-hmm. and my children. I took care of his parents. I'm taking care of my parents, took care of my children.
Wow.
Take care of, I kind of think of my patients as my children too. I guess you'd call that maternalistic instead of paternalistic.
Well, you have to have like boatloads of patients just because you're doing all those things. I always tell people when you want more of something, you know, whether that's patience, strength at the gym, whatever, mm-hmm. More requires, you know, a constant, more testing of that thing, right?
Right.
So with all those hats, you get patients test regularly.
I do. But you know what? I feel like I actually love my patients. They give me energy.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like almost, well, they're not my children, and a lot of them are actually older than me. So, but but I care about them a lot. And mm-hmm. so it really colors a lot of what I do
yeah.
through the day and, you know, a lot of who I am. And like if you mess with my patients, I'm going to get like white hot rage, just like if you mess with my kids.
So what's a like typical day look like for you?
Well,
in Amy's world.
Oh my gosh, it's been so insane the past 5 months because of my campaign for Congress.
So let's say prior to 5 months.
Prior to five months ago.
Like? What's a regular day like?
A regular day would be I would get up, get to work like by 7 or 8, work until like 7 or 8, come home.
And that's the physician?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I would come home like, oh, and I hate to say microwave some food. Yeah, I can't lie. I don't actually practice what I preach.
I think that's a lot. You know what? We're gonna just pause right here for a second because I'm gonna validate you for a second, okay? Because this is a fair argument, I think. As many times, there's obviously some people who don't practice what they preach, for very what I would say, you know, right? I'm biased, unjustifiable reasons. But for another sect of us, I think in those moments, it's a way to kind of exhale. Like, right? Like, because you're kind of operating at this optimal, like, high maybe level throughout the rest of your day, whatever your career, you know, space you're in. Yeah. And when you come home, that's your chance to kind of, like, take your jacket off, take your shoes, like, you know, kind of decompress, yeah. Exhale all the rest, you know, whatever the day is bringing. So I get that part. So continue.
Okay.
So you don't really practice what you preach at home. We'll breeze over that. Maybe we'll edit that part out.
Right. But it's like if I do microwave a meal, which I usually do, it's like it's a healthy choice meal or something, right?
That's right. Healthy choice is awesome.
It's not like a, I don't know, not like
the sodium's not that crazy.
Hungry man. It's healthy choice. Give me a break, right? So I do that. And then, you know, I'm like super tired. So I kind of wind down. I don't actually watch TV or anything, but what I do is either read or I go onto Quora and okay. I give medical answers to people who have questions.
Okay, I've heard of one of those. I haven't heard of Quora, but Quora, yeah, there's like several like
there's a lot of those internet sites, and I have like about 120 million views.
Wow. What's the most like common like question thing like you've seen on those forums that like people are looking for advice on?
Oh, they will. I actually have one piece that says, Dr. Chai, ask me anything. And people really do ask anything.
I bet. Get what you ask for.
But usually they'll be asking me like, sometimes it's kind of sad, like, what's the saddest thing you've ever seen as a doctor? Or
they're not asking just... I'm thinking they're just asking medical questions about themselves. But they get to ask you literally anything.
Literally anything.
Like and stuff about you.
Yeah, stuff about me. And probably like there's a little bit of therapy there too. Because like sometimes I just feel like, oh, you know, I'll just say a little bit of something from my life just because I'm getting ready for bed and I just need to like exercise my fingers by typing a little bit. And but a lot of them is medical questions. Like if... Like a lot of times people go online and they have had a CT scan with a spot on it and they like ask the internet, am I going to die or something?
And that is the worst.
Yeah. And it's like, did you just Google what this spot could possibly be?
Yes.
And it's like, that was probably a very
bad idea. What happened.
Because the first thing that always comes up on Google is like the worst possible outcome. Just relax. It's probably going to be fine, you know.
So. That's really scary, though. I mean, honestly, like for me, those following the channel and the, you know, social media, maybe from I think it's like October last year up until January mm-hmm. of this year. In October, I had a blood clot out of nowhere.
Oh, wow.
In my right shoulder and then moving towards my lungs. I had 4 surgeries that followed, including a rib being removed. And I'm someone who's never had.
Was it compressing medical, on a blood vessel?
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
Okay, yeah. So they tried several, you know, they tried several procedures to try to like just balloon it, you know.
Yeah.
That wasn't working. It was really crazy.
And did your wife say, you better not be getting another wife out of that rib?
No.
Okay, just guess.
But the craziest thing is, you know, because I was otherwise really healthy and have never had any medical problems,
scary.
I went online to just see, like, you know, stuff about blood clots.
Yeah. And cancer.
Cancer is, it is the worst.
It's the first thing that comes up every time.
Yeah.
Most of the time it isn't.
Yeah. So I'm on, like, blood thinners twice a day now.
Yeah.
They want to do another procedure. I told my surgeon to, you know, give me maybe till next year. He's like, it's not, you know, urgent.
Not urgent.
He's like, you've been through a lot, you know, already so far. He's like, so I can understand you wanting a break from procedures.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, we'll circle back next year and see, you know. But he's like, you know, if you just stick with the, you know, medication for now. I check in with him every couple months to just monitor it and see how's things looking. But that's scary.
It's very scary, especially when you're a young parent.
Yes.
And actually, in my book, I tell a little bit of a story about what happened to me. Actually, I was about your age or a little bit younger when I had a very serious health incident. And it really changed everything for me about how I view the world, how I view my career, how I view my family.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was working quite a bit.
And when you say, not to cut you off, when you say how you view your career and how you view family, was your career, at least in the medical field, was that something like already kind of solidified when you started your family? Like you were already
a
physician?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, my husband and I have been together like since undergraduate school, but we had been married a long time. We couldn't really have time to have kids until after we had finished the training. And so then I had this disturbing mass in my lung, and it was huge, and they didn't know what it was. I had a lot of bad things happen. I ended up having a lung collapse. I ended up with a chest tube in the hospital. Nobody knew what was wrong. And I was a physician. It was actually at Hopkins at the time, which is in Baltimore. And I was out of work for a couple months, and then I called them back. I said, you know, I'm feeling well enough that I can go back to work. And they're like, oh, we thought we were going to die. So we went ahead and replaced your job. And I'm like, you thought I was going to die? Well, it would have been nice to say, like, get well soon or something. But they didn't.
That's crazy.
Yeah, they thought I was going to die. And so I didn't.
What did you think? I mean, were you that frightened at some point?
I was even that frightened yourself? Yeah. And I went out to Mayo Clinic and they said, we had another patient with your disease, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, well, how's he doing? They said, oh, he's dead. And I'm like, oh.
That's inspiring.
I said, well, what can you do? They said, there actually isn't any treatment. So it was bad. But then I actually had sort of it actually spontaneously went away.
Well, on this show, we say praise God for that.
Let's
put the hand claps for that. We'll give her the blue button for that one, guys.
Yeah, and so it was a very scary thing, very scary thing. It was very hard.
And that was that you were just starting to be a mom, or you said you were a little younger than me?
I was a little younger. I had two children. They were both preschool age.
At that time?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And I was afraid that, you know, like, they wouldn't remember me if I died.
Exactly. Like, they're not going to have a mom. That's frightening.
And so I was really afraid of that.
And that's where kind of I was because, like I said, we have a three-month-old.
Right.
So at that time where I was having these surgeries, my wife is pregnant, and I'm like, no way. Like,
I know.
Like, one, I'm like, okay, right. So you take the very overwhelming thing and you kind of like start to, like, in your mind, break it down into these like stages. Like, okay, I at least have to be here to see this baby. Right.
Right,
okay. So
right.
Then July comes, you know, baby's born. And then let me back up. Even before that, the last 50 days, Mom had to stay admitted into the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm coming off of the four surgeries.
And you're having Mom's going, the other kids, right?
Exactly. So Mom's going into the hospital for 50 days. I'm trying to manage having sitters or people stay at the house with the kids while I go see and visit mom when I can. She's losing it.
Wow.
Sitting there for day after day.
That's.
She's got, you know, books, crossword puzzles, things to try to like keep her mind. But, you know, we're doing the FaceTime thing at home at night, falling asleep with each other on the phone, FaceTime, just try to give her some normalcy so she can get this baby across the finish line.
Yeah. Wow.
Because my biggest thing was I didn't want, you know, she had the, she started with placenta previa. That was the first thing.
Oh, wow.
That improved. Yeah. That got better. But as a result of that getting better, it created another condition that sounds similar, like, you know, previa or something. It was like medical names. But it was another thing that made it where if the baby was to pass through naturally, like the vessels were attached to the baby or something.
Yeah.
So something like that. So now she's like, well, the baby's growing fine. The baby's healthy. The baby's perfectly fine. She's fine. She doesn't feel pain. But just because if she goes into labor, she could bleed out or the baby could bleed out in a matter of minutes.
Like, they're like very, very fast. Yeah.
Yeah. So for her, that was very frustrating because she's like, I'm not feeling any pain. I'm not discomfort. The baby, every time you check the baby's perfectly fine. Why do I have to be here in the hospital? Day after day,
for you guys.
So it was all about. Yeah, it was all like just a, you know, a just in case,
right?
And that really annoyed her. So, for me, I was like, well, it doesn't seem like the condition itself is really this big scary threat. As I'm seeing her spend each day in the hospital, though, watching her emotional mental state, in my head, I'm going, at this point, stress looks like a more pending threat to her or this baby, you know, right now, like just stress, like the silent killer. Like, I'm like, she's really losing it. Like, a couple times I've got like texts while I'm at home, like, I'm ready to pack my bags now.
Yeah, that would be so hard.
It's so hard.
But I think, like, what goes through your mind when you're a young parent and you have a serious, potentially life threatening problem is it really puts everything in your life into a very unique focus.
Oh, yeah.
And for me, it was like, what am I going to prioritize in my life? And I'd put everything,
absolutely.
I'd put so much into my career, and I really wanted to be like a chairman or something like really prestigious. But then I thought, you know what? At the end of the day, I'd rather raise my own children, and if I'm going to die, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's most important.
If I'm going to die. So, I mean, and that's kind of how this book actually kind of came up, is because I actually started homeschooling eventually through middle school for the kids.
So how long has that been?
The homeschooling, I started in middle school and I did through the end of high school for both of them.
Long ago was that? Like how?
That now has been about 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah, because they're both graduated young adults now.
So this was like much further ahead of the whole like pandemic rush of homeschooling.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. Yeah.
Because that was a big catalyst for many families.
Yeah.
Myself included, not, you know, to the bona fide degree, but just when they had, like, parents were getting the option of doing, like, virtual.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I'd rather be home with them, you know, to kind of guide that. I will say, if I felt I had the time and proper attention that I think they need, I'd choose to homeschool my kids full time. Like, that would be...
Yeah.
The thing for me. And I think
it's actually so much fun, and it's not as hard as people think.
Yeah, I could see the fun part. I had tons of fun, at least during, you know, trying it out with the whole, you know, with the pandemic and distance learning thing of virtual learning. Mm-hmm. I could see the benefits for sure.
Yeah.
One, because I think the biggest benefit as a parent I saw was I was able to see for myself where my child's gaps in education were.
Right.
Like where they needed help. Whereas before, you know, they'd come home with something or whatever the work is or homework they're coming home with. Sometimes it's like they're skating through it. It's not something that they need to like work on or need help in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, it looks like the focus should be more of this area because this is where it looks like you're, you know, you need kind of strengthen. I mean, I was able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and it's, and having parents involved is so important. And like, because of my work where I work now, I treat people with addictions and complex mental health problems, but mostly addictions. And by the time, but what people don't know is actually addiction is a pediatric disease.
Really? What do you mean by that?
Well, what
do
I,
me a favor. Yeah. Lean into towards your cushion that way so you can.
Okay.
So we can not lose you on the mic.
Okay. Because like probably 90% of my patients who are addicted to fentanyl or heroin or coke or whatever, they were addicted or using heavily before the age of 18. So if we keep people.
So you don't mean that it's something that's diagnosed when someone's a kid or a child or something?
Well, the problem is there's not enough people. It's so complex. Right now, and that's where the school thing comes in, and that's kind of one of the ways I got involved in running for Congress.
Yeah.
Is because there's not enough doctors who treat addiction to go around. We're getting flooded with patients, and I keep hearing the same stories over and over. People drop out of school, people join a gang, people see their friends getting shot dead, people get PTSD, they are using drugs, they get arrested, they go to prison, and then CCSD mandates that they come and see me, or whatever, they go to drug court or something, or they are in the hospital after an overdose and they survive, and then they come and see me. And I'm like, you know, this is a pediatric disease, the way to intervene is when the kids are little. And some of the data out there is if you can't read on grade level by the age of third grade, which is right around 10-ish years old, and that's when they do that nationally normed test that they do during third grade. If you're not reading on grade level at that point, you have a 63% probability, 63% probability of ending up either in prison or on welfare.
Wow.
And when you do the math, in New Haven City, only 17% of third graders were reading on grade level. 17%. That means 52% of New Haven kids are destined for the school to prison pipeline. And I'm like,
wow.
I can't see that many patients. This is a crime against humanity. And a lot of these kids are traumatized. A lot of these kids are abused. A lot of these kids grow up seeing violence. A lot of these kids never really had anybody say they love them. And then they act out with behaviors, you know, because they need comfort. They need love. Yeah. They need stuff like that. And then they get punished for it. And that just drives them further away. And they get told like, oh, you're bad. You're bad. And then they start acting out bad. And there's a group of people I was just meeting with them. And it's like, we can't wait for the government to step in. This is a crisis. Mm. And, you know, no matter what happens on November 8th, on November 9th, I'm going to be out in New Haven trying to get people together. I've got, you know, a coalition of people that I'm working with, people trying to get dads to be facilitated in with their kids.
Yeah, that's actually one of the programs I work with that I consult with out of Bridgeport.
Oh,
actually,
okay.
Is a targeted for young dads.
Oh, right.
24 years old and under. To one, if they have some type of you know, criminal background, to help them with job placement, job training agencies, really to, you know, connect them with other community stakeholders and agencies. That are really trying to advocate for that as well. Mentoring.
Yeah.
Really, really, really great program. GBAP is the nonprofit. that I consult with doing that. The Teen Fathers Program is what it's called. Okay. But oddly, it's like the name is misleading because it's called Teen Fathers, but I guess it's categorized that based on the federal government definition of what they're including as a teen. So that's ages 24 years and under.
Well,
but yeah, that's extremely one thing that I know for sure is needed is, you know, fathers who become fathers, at least definitely at a young age, they have the weight of all those other things you just named happening. Right. And those are only things that prevent them all the more from being able to be active fathers as they should.
Right. And they never had it modeled to them. They never had anybody really care about them. They weren't like, didn't have somebody reading a story. I mean, that sounds kind of maudlin to say this, but it's like they never had anyone reading them a bedtime story, but it's actually true.
No, that's a fact. I didn't grow up with bedtime stories. I'm born and raised in New Haven to teenage parents myself.
Oh, okay.
So I which is why I have a passion for a lot of those, you know, particular demographics is I'm one of the lucky ones, you know? You know, I had grandparents that, you know, two grandmothers who were phenomenal, you know, that kind of took the baton until my parents got older and, you know, took that. But you're absolutely right. Those are the, you know, conditions that we still see in New Haven.
Right.
Are things that I was growing up in.
Right. And you see people saying, oh, there's so much crime. And it's like, why do you think there's so much crime? Because kids aren't, they're not succeeding in school. And there's just a vicious cycle. If they're not, if they have traumas from home, if they've the abuse, the trauma, the complete lack of access to pediatric psych, the complete lack of understanding by the established people actually in the schools who don't know how to deal with behaviors.
Yeah,
they don't know how to deal with trauma. So I actually have a girlfriend who is a pediatric psychiatrist, and she also works at Yale with someone who is a pediatric addiction specialist. I'm going to try to suck them in for free.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to get people to volunteer as tutors. You saw the woman at the Lit Fest who was doing the grammar stuff next to my table. She said she could do like a several hour conference where
Dr. Bro Bailey.
Yeah.
That's my aunt.
Oh, was that your aunt?
That's why I was there.
Oh my gosh. Okay. She was wonderful. Okay.
I come from some great stock.
You do. Oh my gosh. Okay. So I was like, we could hire her to come down
she's phenomenal.
She could do, like, she could teach tutors how to do this because she's all this literary specialist.
That's what she does.
So I thought, you know, we get groups, we get community people who are willing to set some time aside. We can't wait for the government to fix things because it's not going to fix things. It's been, I mean, it's just gotten worse and worse over time. They dump money. Where does the money go, right?
Yeah.
It's like, what happened to the money?
Well, and too, like a big idea that I have, and like I said, I the listeners of the show, they know we don't get too big on politics here. But just that idea, the principle of what I would call, you know, stating the obvious, you know, we can't wait on the government.
Right.
I'd take that thought personally one step further and go, in a lot of respects, when it comes to like our homes and inside our homes and, you know, family, we shouldn't. We shouldn't be waiting on, you know.
Right,
I mean?
We shouldn't be.
For a large part, we should be taking the reins.
We need to take our own.
And empowering those, you know, families from the inside out.
Right, and that takes, I mean, that takes a lot of people working together.
Absolutely.
And it probably requires a lot of volunteer time, which for me is okay. I mean, I just have to make enough money to take care of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, I mean, I don't have to work the long hours.
Yeah.
I'd be more than happy because what I really want to do is I really want to end the achievement gap in New Haven. And I want to like.
And what's your association in New Haven? Like, what's your tie to New Haven? Like, why New Haven are you?
Why New Haven?
Are you from New Haven?
It's kind of my area, and I kind of live in the area, and I have friends now in New Haven, and I've sort of gotten involved with them,
and I'm like,
so we got you got you hooked.
I'm hooked, and plus, you know, the problem is like here locally, we're gonna have this large pool of people that are gonna come end up seeing me in my clinic, and I don't want them to come to my clinic. I don't want them to be sick and addicted. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I want them to be well.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I love my patients, but I'd rather they didn't become my patients, you know?
Yeah.
I'd rather they were well. And if I put myself out of a job, that's totally fine with me.
You know that, you know, that's a big conspiracy there. Is like doctors don't really want patients to get healthy because then you're out of a job.
I know, right?
That's not true.
No. It's like we are so overworked. We just are so understaffed. It's like, you know, if we could cut that down by half.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
anything, I used to say the same thing. Being, I was a New Haven police officer for 7 years.
Oh, you were.
Yep, and. A big, you know, another misconception even with that, you know, Jarvis, everybody just had this idea that you were trying to arrest them for anything.
Right, right.
And I'm like, do you know how much I'd rather not do the paperwork? I really want to find a way where I don't have to arrest you.
Oh.
So help me help you, you know?
Do you have a ticket quota? I have to ask you this question.
Oh, God, I hear the ticket quota myth. No, there is no ticket quota.
Oh, okay.
The best stretch of that idea, I can say where that may come from, at least for city cops. It's different for state police. They have their own kind of thing. I worked the overnight shift when I was working in New Haven. And at the end of your shift, when you hand in your keys for your patrol vehicle, you hand in also, or it used to be, I think they've moved from a totally paperless system now. Kind of really feeling old now, dating myself. So you handed in your clipboard with like this printed out paper log. And the log had these like columns where you write like what was the code of the call you went on, the time, and then like maybe the address. And if you worked overnight on, let's say, a Tuesday night, you know, it's not the weekend. It's like the city kind of goes to sleep on a regular weekday at, you know, 2 a.m., you know, so... If you handed in your sheet, your log at the end of the shift at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning and it had nothing on it, you know, you kind of got side-eyed, by the supervisor.
Let me see who
you know, so it's like, it wasn't a log that had to be arrest, but it had to be like, you know, you doing something. Yeah, so even if it was like, hey, I'll be on, you know, a building check, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To show like, I got out of my car and I walked around and did something. Or, you know, I gave a parking ticket or whatever. But, you know, that's where kind of some of the pressure from higher up could be on the guys on the street that didn't be active.
So that's a myth then. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
At least for us. It might be a state police thing. Those guys might have it harder.
They might.
You know?
It's like, we're going to,
But yeah. So the thing for, you know, me, like I said at the top of the show, what really just... you know, blows me away about like all the things you have your hand in. One, you know, kudos to you that, you know, be someone in your role, such as yourself, like a physician who sounds like you care about anything other than just your salary. So I appreciate that being a New Haven born, bred, you know, resident and that you have a heart for the city. So I hope that, you know, continues. Best of luck with, you know, your campaign as you continue to, you know, to affect real change. When it comes to your career, your aspirations or goals, even like in a, you know, political space, and then kind of having that overlaid with like family, like you're taking care of your, you know, your elderly parents, which how old, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah. My dad is going to be 91 and my mom 88.
Wow.
Yeah.
And any small kids still?
My kids have graduated college now. So they're like
in
their
kids.
20s. They're all in their 20s. Yeah.
Okay. So when they were younger, they experienced life of mom being physician. That busy space. In my head, I think when I think of a doctor or physician, these are the type of people in our society who just because of the work they do and the hours they do it, they do not have room for family. They're lucky, and this is just in my head. they're lucky if they have time for marriage. If they pull that off, they're really lucky if they have time for marriage and children.
I know. It's true.
I want to know just, could you share with us a little bit of like just what that transitional period started to look like for you in your career? Like once you were a physician, you're working, you know, you kind of, you know, got that ball rolling, and then now you're married, and then enter the time you decided to enter kids into the mix. Like what was going on through your head, first of all? Like, was it something that you felt just really confident about? Like, I got this, so I'm going to go for it.
Or, oh, no, not at all. I mean, it was scary. It was scary. I didn't know how I was going to take care of my kids, to be honest. And we would like you trade the kids off. I sometimes would be at work and my husband would get home. We'd have a babysitter, and then she would switch off the baby to my husband. And then sometimes he would get called in. He'd have to bring the baby into the hospital and ask a nurse to watch the baby so he could go into the operating room. And it's like,
wow.
And he said, it's okay, Amy. The nurses love the baby.
Oh, of course. Everybody loves the baby.
It's like, but I'm sure they do, but the nurse's job isn't to babysit our child. And so that was really hard. And I couldn't.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't, because, like, you could be on call and then you'd have to leave the house, and you couldn't leave the house. So most people do it by having a live-in, either a live-in nanny or a live-in.
Because the hours you need them are,
you need
could
them.
Be
yeah,
anything.
It could be any time. And we didn't have a house big enough to have like a room for a live-in person.
Okay.
And we didn't have like an adult grandparent that could come live with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were basically on our own. It was really hard. It was really, really hard. And then so I ended up having to get like a daytime job where I could sort of like try to rush back to the daycare. At one point I had each child in different daycares. I'd have to get up a couple hours before
Amy,
I had to leave.
Killing yourself.
And it's like, I was just dying. And then, you know, when I got so ill that I had to cut back on my time, it was almost like a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
Because I really had to reevaluate my priorities so much. And so I really had cut back my hours then. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that if by chance I was going to be dead, I wanted to spend more time at home.
Yeah.
So I had just cut it down to like 3 days a week. And so I had been working kind of part time, which is still a lot of hours typically. But it was a real change. It was very much... And here's something really important that I learned, and that is how your career becomes your identity, and it really shouldn't be your identity.
No.
Your career is not who you are. It isn't who you are. No. And I was letting my career kind of define me as a person, and then when I stopped doing the kind of work that I was trained to, I had a huge identity crisis and I became really depressed, and it's like, what's happening to my life? And that was something that I had to really work through and say, you know what? My career isn't who I am.
Hmm.
You know?
Was at the time where was your husband going through similar just kind of thought changes or just approaches in how he was? Because you guys both were, you know, physicians.
Yeah, we were both physicians. Yeah, but he was still climbing the academic ladder, actually. And I think he felt even more pressure to do that because I had to back down.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So
so it's like almost if I can, you know, provide at this level, it kind of frees up.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Mom just kind of take a step back and.
Yeah. And when I say we didn't have a very big house initially, like we have a pretty big house now, but we didn't then. And partly it was because we had sort of planned to be able to live on one income just in the event that anything would happen. And it did happen.
That was a pretty smart plan.
Yeah. And it's like, we're both working. Let's not plan to spend any more than one person's salary.
That makes sense.
If something happens, we're not going to lose our house.
Yeah, I love that.
And so that's what we did. And I was really, really glad that we didn't buy a more expensive house.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, yeah, so that was something that I was really glad about.
So you have this kind of transitional period where you realize, like, I don't want to be defined by my career.
Correct.
If something is to happen to me, I want to make sure my kids know me, they remember me.
Right.
All right? Right. There's that. You sound like you have a very supportive, you know, spouse during this period, which is key. You guys did some very foundational things out the gate, which is making sure, you know, you didn't go out and buy this $1 million house that is going to need both of you to be kind of operating at this really, really high level, you know, as far as work and all these hours. When you fast forward and your kids they're in their 20s now.
Yeah.
Do you have like conversations with them, or do they have conversations with you rather about any of that time when they were young and kind of watching all of these kind of transitions or transformations in their life? Like, have you been able to hear from them how it's impacted them?
I have. And it's kind of funny. They said, why didn't you start homeschooling us earlier?
Oh, man.
And my daughter went to when she went to college, and everybody was like, oh, you were homeschooled. Like, she was an alien from another planet.
Yeah.
And then she would troll them. Like, she would say, my mother taught me how to make matching denim jumpers, and I had to embroider I love mom on my jumper.
That's so awesome.
It was so funny. And they believed her, of course.
Yeah,
they believed her. But it was very funny because they think if you're homeschooled, you're some sort of a freak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, well, that's what television teaches us.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, homeschool means you're... I think the thing that TV gets right, though, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it does gives us the idea that homeschool kids are typically, you know, smarter, maybe. Maybe you learn more things than the rest of us, but you're not cool. You're definitely not
right,
cool.
Right,
you're
not cool.
You're definitely trading in your intelligence for your cool card.
Yeah. It's like, and I was like, you know, I was never cool myself. So I was like, okay, I don't have to be cool. They don't need to be cool either.
They don't need to be cool either. Oh, I don't know if that's a good thing, Amy. I don't know. Maybe that's a bit selfish.
Yeah, we're total geeks.
I wasn't cool. So you guys don't have to worry about being cool.
Yeah, being cool, nah.
But I guess that could be very pressure. A lot of pressure if you were like, you know, prom queen, super cool, you know, mom. And then like, I'm not allowing my kids to do this. But I think there's so many things that on the back end, right? Those, like when you're homeschooled, on the back end, like the outcomes are amazing.
Yeah.
The outcomes
are really, really good. When my son went to school, he actually we were living in the Baltimore area at the time. He was named the top student in the state of Maryland. And so that's how I won the U.S. Presidential Teacher Award from Obama at that time.
Wow.
And then...
Hold up. You were able to win a teacher award from being a homeschool teacher?
Yep. I was competing against regular teachers.
I thought that's only like awards for regular institution.
It depends on your student. Because if your student wins the top in the state, they name...
Who's that student's teacher?
The most influential teacher in their achievements. And of course, it was me.
That's fair.
I mean, you
can't acknowledge the creation without the creator.
So I'm the brains behind this.
So that's kind of where
the book came out of, is kind of the home educating experience and how my husband and I saw the world differently so much because he's Chinese and I'm white.
Either of you had homeschooling when you were kids?
No, we didn't. And we were both, public school students.
Okay.
And so Asian people have this very different idea of parenting and education compared to
American Westerners.
That's why it says East, West, Love, Learn. And so I used the five elements of traditional Chinese culture to come up with some ideas. And the first one is fire, which represents the passion. The second one is earth, which represents the family. The third one is wood, which represents growth. The fourth is water, representing adaptability to change. And then the fifth element is actually metal, which represents the character that you form inside the child. And so these five elements of parenting is
I like that metal one.
Yeah. And it's like very much these are the things a child needs. Like I'll talk about some interaction here. Like fire is passion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a fire can burn out of control. Yes. If you don't want it to burn out of control, you surround it with what? Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Earth is the family, right?
Mm.
And what grows out of the earth grows a tree, right? And the tree is your education. It comes out of the family.
Is it weird that I'm seeing like an X-Men movie scene in my head while you describe this? Yeah. This sounds amazing.
It's just thinking about...
Yeah, framing it that way.
Framing it, yeah. And then, of course, everything fails without the character, mm-hmm. the metal that comes, you know, yes. from your what you instill into the child, their values, their character, their morals, their beliefs, how important that is to who they turn out as people to be.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the core of my thoughts about every culture has good and bad ideas about parenting, and sometimes we do it wrong, and if you don't mess up your kids too bad, you know, you consider it a win.
I love that. You got to repeat that. That's what we call a bar on this show. Every culture has good and bad ideas of parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
I like that.
What I try to do is take the good parts from both.
And yeah, because I think
try not to take the bad parts from both.
Because I think there's this like misconception that there's some culture, there's someone who, you know, does it perfectly.
Yeah, nobody does it perfectly.
And then so you have like kind of this abandonment from any and everything that might be, you know, your culture.
Right.
But that's just it. Like I think we all across, you know, globally, you know, cultures, we all have something that we probably really do well. Mm-hmm. And the key is, you know, pulling from all those things, you know, right? Having like a multitude of, you know, wisdoms, you know, so to speak.
Yeah.
But I love that. I love the whole like five elements thing.
Yeah, it's really helpful to have like I think a visual in your mind, and it just makes that analogy that makes it clear for people to understand. And so that's kind of, you know, it has my story, and then towards the later part of the book, it talks about some sort of bread and butter educational tips, like whether you're home educating or just supplemental educating, some thoughts about what people are going to need to do to really bring the real success for their children. But it also talks about what do we mean by success, too, because I feel like our culture is a little bit messed up when it thinks about what success actually is. And it's not necessarily what our culture says it is. Like, it's not necessarily like if you're not wealthy, for example, or if you don't like drive a expensive car or look a certain way. Mm-hmm. These things are actually not that valuable.
Well, I think it's one of those things where you know, we find it's one of those really subjective terms, you know, success,
mm-hmm.
right? So success, you know, it's what your goal is, right? It's like, okay, if it's like a flathead screwdriver, you know, mocking a hammer, right? And says, right? Like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, the flathead is like mocking the hammer because the hammer can't, you know, get the screw out, right? And so, okay, is the hammer unsuccessful? Well, yeah, at that particular outcome.
At that outcome, yeah.
Yeah, it is. But there's a goal that the hammer has that it's successful. So it's like, you know, at the point where we all reach kind of, you know, that transitional period in our lives as, you know, young adults going into mm-hmm. adults and, you know, what we plan to do and what we hope to achieve in our lives, like, right? That's the our own individual like measure of success. You know, some people want to be, you know, present parents. Like if I do that well, because maybe I didn't have it, I'm successful. I was a present dad or a present mom and I didn't have one. That's what I'm choosing to, you know, put as my standard. For some, it's money. You know, I'm not successful until I make $1 million.
Yeah.
That's what it is for some. In others, you know, it's totally intangible. It, you know, it's, success is a total, you know, inward thing. It's, you know, do I have peace and resolve and still and love in an otherwise chaotic world? You know, is now I've reached success.
Yeah. And it's so important as you kind of process that to kind of be explicit about what success means to you. Because if you don't, you're going to be wandering around not knowing what you're doing for years and years. And it's very easy to get off track in what you really believe success is. And I tried to instill in my children what I thought success actually is. And I always would tell them the same thing repeatedly so they remember it. And that is that it doesn't matter what you do. What matters is who you are. And what I mean by that is who you are as a person.
Say that one more time.
It doesn't matter what you do. What matters is who you are. Because you could be a street sweeper. You could be an astronaut, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if who you are as a person, as a human, isn't good, then that's not going to be a success.
Mm-hmm.
Because becoming who you are as a person with, you know, your values, your character, your kindness, your willing to serve others, those type of, and I guess those are my intangibles that you were talking about. That's who you are. That's who looks out from behind your eyes. That's who sees the world.
Yeah.
And what you do is really immaterial. Now, our world doesn't really respect you sometimes, like if you're a janitor. And it's like,
absolutely.
My first job was as a janitor. I know how to run those Hild floor buffing machines.
Yeah.
And they like,
those things are heavy.
Those are so heavy. And it, and I was kind of, I was a lot skinnier.
Look at this. Amy the janitor.
And so I was like using this floor buffer and it was like spinning around and it would like pull me across the floor and I'd be going,
I bet.
You know, but the floor, it looks so good. You know, it looks so good and shiny when I was done. But a lot of people are like, oh, you're a janitor. And I also was a waitress. It's like, oh, you're a waitress.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all of a sudden when you're a doctor, it's like, ooh, you're a doctor.
Ooh.
Ooh. But you know what? It doesn't matter.
You're a police officer.
Right. It's like you're the same person.
Yeah.
You're the same person.
Oh, man.
And the respect is for the person inside, not for the exterior, what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nah.
That's my view anyway. I mean, other people may think differently.
You have some pretty, I can't wait to jump into this book with the wife. We started to try to have some intentional unplugging time at the latter part of our evening.
Oh, that's nice. Good idea.
But we have to have, like, sometimes we'll play cards. She's, like, really competitive.
Oh.
Yeah,
cards.
Yeah. She likes to play Crazy Eights.
Oh, I love Crazy Eights. My brother and I used
but
to play that.
She's not really a nice person if she loses though.
Oh,
yeah. I get in trouble. I have to if I know I'm about to win, I put my last card down and I run.
Oh, so you don't you don't actually let her win.
Shout out to the wife. Absolutely not, Amy. No, everybody. No, look, everybody's not a winner. She has to work hard for that win.
Okay.
So we tried to start reading some books, but what I love about this is I'm like kind of like skimming through here while I've heard you talking, and I'm seeing some great headers or sections here. I want to ask you, you have one here in chapter 6 that talks about how can you help your child develop passion?
Yeah.
I don't want you to give away the book, but just give me one nugget.
Sure.
For that.
Yeah. And
how to help your kid develop passion.
The way you help your kid develop passion is to let them try a number of different things and not try to make their passion your passion. Because it's so easy to do that.
Yes.
Like, I was very into singing, actually. And I just loved music and singing. And it turns out, like, my kids weren't really into that. And it was hard for me. It was really hard. And you have to realize it's not your passion. passion. Yes. It's their passion.
So that's like when my
parent,
dad wanted
as a parent, it's like that's really
my dad
hard.
Wanted me to go on to be a archaeologist. And he's like, I need one of my sons to be an archaeologist.
Oh,
like,
that's pretty cool.
I'm like, well, I don't.
I would do that.
I'm not into like getting dirty, Dad. The whole thing.
Oh, okay. I was like, I would totally be an archaeologist.
I don't want to be dirty. I was really much the pretty boy growing up. I was like, nah, not happening. Even like with like sports, they're like, you know, I love basketball. I'm like, you know what? You'd be really good playing football. I'm like, yeah, but then I got to get hit. And
yeah.
Nah. Yeah. But no, that's right. You know, you don't want to make it. But I think how that could happen too, that mistake where, you know, parents make, try to have their passions become their kids' passion. It's like, you know, sometimes people think of having kids as like their second chance at life.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
things that they missed out on and they didn't get to do.
Yeah, living so, vicariously through your child.
Oh my God, it's like totally a thing.
People do that. Yeah.
That's a thing.
It's hard not to do that, actually.
If we're honest, as parents, I'll have to admit the same thing. It's very, like, you know, me being, how we said off air, been a martial artist for just over 30 years now. I've done martial arts since I was 7 years old.
Oh, really?
And when I'm a total girl dad. I have four girls. When they were little, I used to try to take them to class when I was teaching. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, this will be really cool. You know, I'm teaching the class. I'll just bring them on the classes where I teach. And like, you know, I have my kids, you know, they'll be learning martial arts like their dad. And it turned into a babysitting session. Like I got, you know, my oldest will be doing cartwheels in the back. Then I'll have the middle one. She'll be, you know, spinning around, twirling when she's supposed to be standing at attention. Yeah. And I'm trying to teach and show someone else, demonstrate one thing. And then I had the third one at the time, you know, there were just three. She'd be in the car seat off to the side, you know? And it was just dad like playing babysitting and like no one was getting anything else out of it, the other kids. And I'm like, all right, they're totally not into this.
Yeah.
And I kept trying and I kept trying. And I realized I had to just come to the conclusion that they're not into this.
Yeah, they're not. And so, you know, sometimes actually you have to trick your, well, this isn't in the book, but sometimes you have to trick them.
Listen up, guys, you're getting exclusive content,
exclusive
not in the book.
Exclusive content that's not in the book. So there was this, like there is a pop dance school academy like next to mm-hmm. my house that had like it was kind of a girly dance school where they yeah. like learned all these like
ballerina
no it wasn't ballerina it was like pop kind of dance.
Oh, okay.
And I really actually wanted my son to take voice lessons because he has a really beautiful resonant voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, oh, I just signed you up for, you know, Fly Pop Dance Studio or whatever. And the look on his face,
signed you up.
The look on his face was like, like stunned. And there's like no way he's going to go to that dance studio.
How old was he at the time?
He was like 12. And he's like, no. And he said, I'll go take voice lessons instead.
Voice lessons
and
I'm like, nailed it. I love it.
Isn't that evil?
That's called the Jedi mind trick, boys like and girls.
It was like bad. I know. I had some bad parenting moments.
No,
too.
That was awesome. Yeah. I'm taking a page out of that book. Or another excerpt here. We won't go into this one because I want to make sure before we wrap up, we get to the free food for the soul segment of our show. But guys, if you're listening, get this book. Where is this book available first?
Actually, right now, it's on my website.
Oh, yeah. What's the website? Yeah,
it's
East
it's
West
actually,
Love Learn.
It's, I think it's also on Amazon, though. But it's if you can't find it on Amazon, you can also find it docchai2022.com. That's docchai2022.com.
Awesome.
And I think it's also on Amazon.
Okay.
And if you Google Amy Chai, I actually have a couple other books that will come up. I have A Cypress Will Grow, which is a devotional for people with chronic illness.
Yeah.
And I have a book called The Bible or the Axe, which is actually, I ghost wrote it for a guy who he had to flee the South Sudan that I've worked with his NGO. He's a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple other books out there, but this one is East West Love Learn. And I think it's also available print on demand from Amazon, I think, but you can definitely
get it from the website for
get
sure,
it from
guys.
The website, yeah.
But some awesome just segments that are jumping out to me. We have culture and conflict, the how you can help your child develop passion. That's absolutely a good one I want to jump into. You definitely break down the five elements. That's definitely a gold nugget there. You had a section here also called a cheating scandal. That's always an eye grabber.
Yeah.
Boys and girls. So make sure you go check that out. And lots of uncertainty. Tell me, how do you feel about this? That actually made me think of something just now. Not that it probably had, that's probably not what you mean when you say lots of uncertainty in the book, but it made me think of this overwhelming need for many people in leadership or, I'll just say people in leadership. If you're a person in leadership, I feel like there's this overwhelming need to always have an answer. And I think as a result, that can, you know, cause obviously a lot of just, you know, stress, anxiety, and wrong answers just because you have the need to have one.
Right.
So I felt like in these recent months, just this like kind of breaking away of this idea of feeling like I have to always have an answer. For someone, whether it's a debate or whether it's a problem presented to you, you know, maybe you're part of a team or whatever it is, any space, I want to normalize saying, I don't know.
Oh, thank you very much.
Like, is that bad? Like,
no, that is beautiful. That is so
important. Let's normalize, I don't know.
That's so important. And that comes out of my other foundational principle, which actually my husband says all the time to his students. He teaches physicians, mm-hmm. and that is never lie. And a lot of people try to kind of bluff their way through. It's like, oh, do you know this? Oh, yeah. Or, you know, or they try to sort of fake their way through. And it's like,
no go.
Just say, I don't know. Just say, I don't know. Be real about it, because a lot of people don't know, and it's okay to not know.
It's okay to not know.
It's not okay to continue to not know.
Yeah.
But if you don't know, you just go find out.
Yeah.
And sometimes
you realize, can find out together.
Yeah, find out together. And that's okay, too. And as a parent, one of the things I really liked to model for my kids was saying, well, let's find out this. Let's look this up together. And it's kind of modeling how you find answers to those questions. And, you know, a lot of questions don't have answers.
Yeah.
And that's okay too.
That's okay, guys.
Yeah.
Let's not lie.
Yeah. No, never lie.
Just normalize.
Never lie.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So at the end of each show, we like to kind of go over a couple things. One, you know, what are you learning in this, you know, phase of life in the areas of faith, family, and finance? Mm-hmm. To leave with the audience, and then we'll end off with the one nugget you want the listeners to leave this episode with, in general. Maybe something that we already discussed throughout the segment, or something brand new that comes to your mind.
Okay.
Many times when we go through the three Fs, I call them, faith, family, and finance, those in themselves end up being the takeaway for the show, so that's cool too.
Okay.
So I'll just go one at a time. In the area of faith, what are you learning new, would you say?
Okay, well, when I was a kid, there was this song. It was called Joy Bells. I don't know if you ever heard it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was J-O-Y. This must surely mean Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between. Mm-hmm. And it was sung to the sound of jingle bells. But I always felt like putting myself last and serving others was the most important thing I could do.
Uh-huh.
And I have done that for my entire life, putting other people first. I did it a little, maybe to the point where I didn't take care of myself.
Mm. That's not good.
And then I also got this feeling like I have to do more. Because I felt like I could never solve all the problems that I saw in the world. And it was making me crazy because I just felt like I have to change the world. But you don't have to change the world. So not having to actually change the world is a huge relief to me.
The coolest thing about that, right, is when you like take a step back, if every single person had the idea or the focus to have a changed self, that would end up having a changed world.
Oh, you know what? You're so right.
Right? You know?
You're so right.
But we have a lot of us, you know, we look outwardly and it's like this, we see the huge, large, like, you know, pie, like, right, the huge problem.
Yeah.
And go, hey, let's attack that thing. Yeah. And I'm a firm believer in, you know, taking care of the splinter in my eye first.
Right.
You know,
right.
Doing, you know, all that the building blocks, the healing, you know, I've been a big advocate for therapy.
Yes.
Have gone to therapy myself numerous of times throughout my life. And it's made me a better individual, and I think has been the catalyst, the springboard of which I have been able to be a great husband, a great dad, is because I tended to the broken pieces of me.
Yeah.
So yeah, love that. Yeah. The next one, family. What are you learning these days in the area of family?
Well, one of them is really the nature of love and how we as a society have forgotten how to love each other, and how so many of our societal problems are simply due to a lack of human empathy and ability to love. And what people think is love is not always love. People think just in the terms of like, I have a romantic feeling or whatever. That's not what love is. Love is really an action. It's a decision. It's,
yeah, we've talked about that at length on this show.
Yeah, it's about being willing to care about somebody else, even if they can't do anything for you.
Well, you know, it's a decision.
It's a decision.
It doesn't have to be all these feelings.
Yeah, and sometimes your family will disappoint you. And sometimes
that's a whole nother podcast episode, Amy.
Yeah, and sometimes you'll disappoint your family.
Yeah.
And when you do, like as a parent, the number one thing I can say as a parent is to forgive yourself. Forgive yourself. When you look back and you think of all the things you could have done differently, you know what? Forgive yourself.
And that's why I say to my kids, I've told them numerous times, you know, my personal faith is Christian. I've been raised that way my whole life. Mm-hmm. Done my best to raise my kids that way. But one thing I've always told them is dad's not perfect. And because of that, just by nature of that, there's going to be a time where I'm going to fail you.
Yes.
Because I'm not perfect. But that's why dad chooses to, you know, believe in and serve a God who is perfect. To help me fill in the gaps. And so if I can kind of like a handoff, kind of introduce you to that God, someone that's something that's perfect.
Yeah.
That'll never fail you, right?
Right.
It needs to be something greater or higher than me because
right, exactly.
I'm flawed.
Yeah. It's
and
like,
so I don't want you kind of, you know, we have some of these kind of, I think, you know, kind of perverted, you know, parent-child relationships where it's like parents that raise their kids to always depend on them.
Yeah.
Right? Because their parents somehow find purpose in life that way.
Right.
You know, where they have adult kids that still are like
dependent on them. Oh, just wait till they start moving away.
Yeah.
And then you feel like they don't
need. So it's gotta have something bigger than me.
Yeah.
Is, you know, is the thing that I've learned the most probably with family and the role of being a parent.
Yeah.
Is have something that you can, you know, trust and believe in greater than me or any of the people around you, because we're flawed. We're gonna fail. We're gonna disappoint you at some point in time.
Yeah. And we have to admit it. Admit it.
Don't lie. Yes. Page from Mr. Chai's book.
Yes.
Don't lie.
Don't lie.
Lastly, finance.
Finance.
Usually we approach this one because that's such a broad term. Mm-hmm. We approach it from the area of all the either present entrepreneur, we have a big entrepreneur listener base,
mm-hmm.
or would-be entrepreneurs. Or people just, you know, they have a small business. Maybe they don't even call them. This is new to me. I met small business owners that don't actually look at themselves as entrepreneurs. That's kind of weird. I think they maybe define it differently, but in any event, mm-hmm. in the area of finance for you, just in your world, what's some new like nugget that you're learning in that area?
Well, I think, is really not to be anxious about money.
Is that kind of like on the lines of delayed gratification lessons? Like when you say anxious, that's what that first comes
like,
to mind.
Like, you know, I have been very poor, like having like no plumbing type of poor.
Oh,
and
okay.
I have also been.
I don't imagine as an ex-janitor you make a ton of money.
No, I didn't, really.
So what's the lesson?
The lesson is don't be anxious about your money. Money is just a tool. Mm-hmm. It's not the most valuable thing that you have. And, you
I
know,
like that.
Use it wisely.
Leave us with this as we give the people the free food for the soul, the way lunch edifies the body. Mm-hmm. Let's just give them something to edify their soul. You said money is not the most important thing.
Right.
Tell us what is. In the world of Amy.
Okay.
The way she sees it.
The way I see it.
What's the most important thing?
Well, since this is free lunch, I'm going to have to say you are what you eat. And I'm going to use that metaphorically to say the things you put inside yourself are what you become. And just like, you know, that molecule of apple that you just ate becomes part of your muscle tissue or whatever, what you consume mentally, spiritually becomes who you are. So you really are what you eat.
I love that.
And that's your lunch tip for the day. So what I would say is to fill yourself with the things that are going to ultimately satisfy, which might not be the things that you think they are, like the things that satisfy spiritually and is much more to be what you should be consuming rather than, you know, the culture, the anger, the conflict, whatever. Don't eat those things. Don't fill yourself with those things.
I love it.
So
thank you so much.
Well, thanks for the tea. It was very good.
Hey, make sure you guys check out this book, East West Love Learn, 5 Keys to Education, Parenting, and Life by Dr. Amy Chai, the ex-janitor, the present physician, author, mother, and U.S. congressional candidate, guys. Thank you again, Amy, so, so much. It's free lunch, guys. Free food for your soul. Peace.